Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking today with Wesley Smith. Wesley is a former co-author with Ralph Nader of four books. He wrote with Ralph, No Contest, Corporate Lawyers and the Perversion of Justice in America. He's also the author of The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and the book Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. And one of the things that brings Wesley on the show today is that he actually addressed some of my writings after having interviewed me in an article in the National Review called The Transhumanists, The Next Great Threat to Human Dignity. So when someone deigns that I may be the next great threat to human dignity, they definitely deserve a voice on the show. Welcome, Mr. Smith.
Thanks, Jim. Please call me Wesley.
Okay. Wesley, you have been very involved in the anti-euthanasia and assisted suicide movement. What led you to be interested and concerned about the movement towards assisted suicide?
It was interesting. I was working very happily with Ralph Nader and co-authoring books with him, and I had a friend who I later found out was a Hemlock Society member who had more or less befriended me. She was an elderly woman. When I wrote a book called The Lawyer Book, A Nuts and Bolts Guide to Client Survival, which began my writing career, which was how to work with a lawyer and not get screwed, to put it bluntly. And she invited me to speak to her library association, which I happily did. And then somehow, I don't quite recall how, she became transitioned from somebody who wanted me to speak to becoming a personal friend. And she became a personal friend of my mother because they were the same age. And almost as soon as I started being her friend as opposed to the author, she started talking about her future deliverance and her gentle landing and using language like that, talking about how she had her hoard of pills. And I was always rather stunned by that concept. And she and I would go round and round about this idea. And Frances was a very depressed woman. Her husband had left her for a younger woman. He had subsequently gotten Alzheimer's disease. She had very difficult problems with her children that I won't go into. And she'd get suicidal, and then her friends, me among them, and I certainly wasn't her closest friend, would hold interventions. Just as one example, she was ready to kill herself, and then her husband, through his new wife, cut off her alimony. Well, if you really want to die, who cares, right? Well, suddenly the suicide was off, and Frances was off to court on a full head of steam to get her alimony back. And it struck me that what Frances was really desperately looking for was a reason to keep on going. But eventually, she did kill herself, put a plastic bag over her head, and took drugs. And I was very upset and disturbed by this. She was not terminally ill. She needed a hip replacement. She had been diagnosed with leukemia, but it was treatable. She had some other issues, a nerve condition that was painful, but she wouldn't take her pain medication. And so I asked her executrix, please send me her suicide file, which I knew she'd have, because she was very organized, and I got that, and it was filled with Hemlock Society literature, which I was just appalled and disgusted at, because it, in essence, what they did was they almost proselytized for suicide. I remember one of the stories was how this loved one of the writer had giggled and relished the experience. I mean, we were talking about suicide here, and how people, when someone would say, I want to kill myself because I'm sick, would immediately jump courageously to help get the poison to do it. And these Hemlock Society, Hemlock Quarterlies, also had the drugs to take and their level of toxicity. Frances had underscored all of these things in yellow marking pen. And also an article about how to use a plastic bag, which is precisely what she did. I was really disgusted and enraged, because here these people who didn't know her, who I called the whisperers, gave her moral permission to commit suicide and taught her how to do it, while those who did know her and her friends were trying to keep her with us. It was almost like this tug of war. So I wrote a article that appeared in the June 28, 1993 Newsweek, the My Turn section, called The Whispers of Strangers. And it got into my thoughts about what happened to Frances and what I saw as a threat to vulnerable people from this euthanasia movement that I was only just learning about. That led to so much hate mail that I was frankly stunned. I thought, when did the culture change and where was I when that happened? And then I decided to start working on these issues, talked to Ralph about it, explained why. He said, you know, go for it, buddy. And that started a whole path that I've walked since 1993 that I never planned.
That path has led to the pages of the National Review. Does that reflect that you have found more comfort and you're more in tune with the zeitgeist that you find in the cultural conservative circles than you do on the left now?
Well, that's all very interesting because, you know, when I start to write these about these issues, I'd submit them to publications like The Nation, and they weren't interested. So I submitted them to people like The National Review or Weekly Standard, and they were interested. And I believe as a writer in getting published and getting the word out. And in fact, there are a lot of, I've talked to a lot of progressives who oppose some of these agendas, who oppose some of the bioethics agendas, who oppose assisted suicide, certainly oppose cloning, and they have the same complaint that the journals of the left are very reluctant to get involved. I think there's a whole complex reason about that surrounding the politics of abortion and some other issues. But I'm a public advocate, and I'm going to get my work out, and I'm going to speak. And I have found, and do believe, that the old political paradigm that held true during the Cold War is shifting. That is, Jeremy Rifkin, who I've interviewed for my next book, which will be called A Consumer's Guide to Brave New World, said he looks at it, and he's certainly not a conservative, as the new paradigm is going to be those who see the intrinsic value of human life versus those who have a more utilitarian view and who don't see human life as valuable, say ultimately valuable, simply and merely because it is human. And on these bioethical issues, ranging from transhumanism to personhood theory to, we can get into these, feudal care theory, where some doctors are now, and ethicists, bioethicists are saying that doctors should be able to say no to wanted life-sustaining treatment based on the doctor's or bioethics perspective as to the quality of life of the patient. What I find very much at threat is universal human equality. So I guess I'm speaking as being a lawyer. I always I'm making a short story long. I have friends in both liberal camps, quote unquote, and conservative camps now, and tell the same message to both.
Let's take a step back. You mentioned that one of the reasons why people in progressive camps are leery of the idea that we should be telling people not to, that they can't have assisted suicide or that they can't have reproductive liberties of one kind or another is because the left...
Those two are different things. Let's not confuse them. And let's also not confuse reproductive liberties, e.g. abortion, with things such as cloning. I think we have to be very careful to define what we're talking about.
Well, that was, in fact, the question. I mean, that many of us, and certainly most transhumanists, think that the ability for human beings to control their own bodies and determine what's done with them, have informed consent, leads naturally to the right to determine that you should be able to genetically engineer yourself or take your own life, take drugs if you choose to take drugs, et cetera. A number of bodily liberties that our more paternalistic society denies us.
Well, it's a libertarian approach, and I'm now beginning to focus on some of this transhumanism that I was not aware of up till about 6 weeks ago. I look at two different things, and they all have subtext. First off, there is the idea of what you do to yourself, which is one thing, but also as part of transhumanism, as I understand it, is what you do to progeny or clones, which is not yourself. So I think you have to make a distinction there. If a person wants to modify themselves, I think there certainly should be some limits because I think we have to protect people from themselves sometimes. For example, if somebody wants to take a cigarette and burn their arm, you know, a compassionate society protects people from doing that to themselves. That's why we have suicide prevention centers. There are some people now who are becoming quite obsessed and desirous of becoming amputees, and it strikes me that doctors should not comply with that request to be an amputee. Because actually what a doctor would be doing, even though it might be choice, is harming the patient rather than helping the patient. Then there is the issue of genetic engineering of clones or of progeny, which you are not doing to yourself, but you're doing to offspring or replicants, whatever we would wish to call it, and potentially on down the line, and are basically trying, and I think this is the intent, to seize control of human evolution, which I find to be incredibly hubristic, arrogant, and short-sighted.
Well, okay, well, let's return to the question of whether bodily autonomy extends to being able to have the kind of children that you want. But let's stick for the moment with assisted suicide.
Sure.
The argument that would be that why shouldn't one be able to have control over your own body and determine the means of your own death?
Let me ask you this. Would you put any limit on that?
Well, I would put the same limit on it that every referendum that's ever been proposed in the United States has put, which is that the patient should have to be seen by a psychiatrist, determined not to be clinically depressed in a way that can be treated, and that there should be a waiting period before they get access to the medications or the assistance.
Well, first, there's some mistaken facts there. There is no requirement in any assisted suicide proposal or law that every person who wants assisted suicide see a psychiatrist. In Oregon, that is only required if the physician believes that the person may not be able to make decisions competently. So most of the people who commit assisted suicide in Oregon never see a psychiatrist. And even when they have to see a psychiatrist, it's a consultation. It's not treatment. There is no requirement that somebody who, say, is depressed be treated. Then there is the problem of doctor shopping. Just as an example, there's a case in Oregon called the Kate Cheney case, C-H-E-N-E-Y. This was reported by the Oregonian. And the reason the Oregonian got the story was that the family of Kate Cheney brought this to them because they were upset because the hurdles, as they put it, to assisted suicide for Kate Cheney were too stringent. Kate Cheney had been diagnosed with dementia, and she had been diagnosed with a terminal cancer. When she wanted assisted suicide, her doctor said, "Well, I'm not sure that Kate Cheney understands what's going on here." The doctor sent, who was a Kaiser Permanente doctor, HMO. This doctor sent Kate Cheney to a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist refused to okay the assisted suicide because the psychiatrist said the real agenda was not Kate Cheney's, but Kate Cheney's daughter's. Moreover, the psychiatrist said Kate Cheney didn't have the capacity to go through the process, thought process, to understand what it was she was requesting. Now, if these guidelines were really protecting vulnerable people, that would have been the end of it. But what Kate Cheney's daughter decided to do was get another psychiatrist. So this time Kaiser permitted it, took Kate Cheney to a non-MD psychologist who said, yes, she's got memory problems, for example. She doesn't remember when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And there are family pressures involved, but I think that we should okay this. Then the administrator at Kaiser, who was also a bioethicist, interviewed Cheney and decided to proceed. What happened, which really makes this case disturbing, is that Kate Cheney, the first time she wanted to commit assisted suicide was after she'd had a problem, an accident with her colostomy bag. Then, when she didn't do it, her family, and I'm not saying they sent her to do this on purpose, but she was sent to a nursing home, perhaps to give the family respite for a week. The very day she returned from the nursing home was when she committed assisted suicide. And by the way, once the poison or the drugs, whatever you want to call it, are prescribed in Oregon, there is no further medical involvement in that case unless the doctor chooses to. There was nobody to take a look to understand whether Kate Cheney even knew she was taking poison pills. There was no presence by the physician.
I agree, but that's only because we don't have the courage in the United States to have actual doctor-patient relationship administer these drugs. In Holland, where they're actually doing this, a physician comes to your home and determines the competence of the situation and actually administers the drugs. Now, let me just understand you, Wesley. Is it your position that under no circumstances could we ever have a law with any series of protections that would allow competent people to control the timing of their own death?
Yeah, I think that you are betraying the very purposes of medicine. You are basically abandoning people When you say yes, of course, we should give you assisted suicide, it seems to me what you're doing is you're confirming the worst fears that people may have about themselves. For example, that I'm no longer lovable, that I'm a burden to my family, that I will be allowed to die in pain and agony. Moreover, it ignores the very many studies that show that even with terminally ill people, and of course, in the Netherlands, they go way beyond terminally ill people. They're even killing disabled babies now. Based on quality of life considerations, and they're allowing rational suicide of people who are depressed. For example, a woman who lost her two children, her psychiatrist assisted her suicide, and the Dutch Supreme Court said that was fine because she would never get better in terms of her emotional suffering. But there are studies for dying people that today they may say, I want to die, I want to get it over with now, and then 3 weeks later they may have a completely different perspective. So what you're saying is that with assisted suicide, that if somebody wants to kill themselves because their business has collapsed or their children have died or they've gotten a divorce, then we will engage in suicide prevention.
No one's saying that in Oregon. You have to be determined to have a terminal illness.
Yes, I agree with that.
Yeah,
but why shouldn't somebody with a terminal illness get the same suicide prevention as somebody
what you're doing,
else?
You're wildly extrapolating on the basis of fear of where the law is going to go way beyond what anyone's proposed.
Well, first off, most of the proposals that have gone out around the world do not limit this to terminal illness. In fact, the new term of art, and the Hemlock Society supports this, is hopeless illness. And a hopeless illness is not a terminal illness at all. Secondly, if you look at the Netherlands, they've gone way past, and they've been doing this since 1973, not only do doctors euthanize terminally ill people who ask for it, but chronically ill people who ask for it. They've now, as I mentioned in the Chabot case, C-H-A-B-O-T, the Supreme Court said it was acceptable for a psychiatrist to assist the suicide of his patient named Hilly, who wanted to be buried between her two dead children. And the Supreme Court said suffering is suffering, and it doesn't matter whether it's physical or emotional. And I don't understand, and that's the logic of euthanasia and assisted suicide. They also, in the Netherlands, Dutch doc study after study, and I'm not talking about opponent studies, but the government study, about 1,000 patients are killed a year by Dutch doctors who haven't asked to be killed, which violates every guideline. And when the doctors then say, well, they didn't have a life worth living, I'm sure they would have wanted this and so forth. So it's really been a disaster in the Netherlands, and
well,
would be here.
Okay. Only
in the Netherlands, they don't have the issue of HMOs and so forth because, you know, if we end up having a cost-cutting form of government financing, what could be cheaper than assisted suicide? It costs $40 to kill somebody in an assisted suicide.
Well, that on that point, I definitely do agree with you. We should have national health insurance here and eliminate that particular thing, but which they do have in Holland.
Yes,
I'm speaking with
make house calls.
I'm speaking with Wesley Smith. He's the author of The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, and Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. I want to take you back for a second to the comment that you made about respect for human life. You see a number of trends, animal rights as one of them.
Yeah, much to my surprise. I've only been recently focusing on that, but yeah.
And transhumanism and a person-centered ethics as all being a part of a cultural move away from respect for human life. Let me just say that that would be a surprising statement for most transhumanists at any rate, because we have coined this phrase thanophilia to describe the love of death in the rest of the society, and most transhumanists are trying to valorize life and stay alive for as long as possible.
But transhumanists want to transform themselves into post-humans.
Right. So the key then becomes respect for human life. So you would say that anyone who respects life that is not human is taking away from respect for human life.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that our first and foremost priority, in fact, I think the only lingua franca we still have in our diverse and multicultural society, which I think is the strength of the United States and the West, is universal human equality. I'm looking at an article you wrote right now called The Future of Death, Chironics and the Telos of Liberal Individualism, in which you create this chart of descending rights, some of which would exclude humans from the same right, for example, to life and bodily integrity as other humans. At the top of your list here, you say type of life, cognitively enhanced post-humans, who you call mature personhood, and those folks have the right to vote and make contracts.
Along with humans.
Well, then you, I'm getting there. Then you say adult humans. Then in the next category, you talk about personhood, which is a lower level than mature personhood. Children, adult apes, severely retarded individuals, and some mammals who have the right to life. Then beneath that, you have infants, severely demented adults, fish, late fetuses, and permanently unconscious people who you call sentient. And you say they don't have the right to suffer, but they have the right not. They don't have the right to life, but they have the right not to suffer unnecessarily. Now you see where certain humans, those with less subjective criteria, that is consciousness, start to be used as objects instead of subjects, and that destroys universal human equality.
Well, I disagree. I think it what destroys human dignity is to treat something that has lost all substance that makes human life meaningful as if it still has it, and to deny the existence of those qualities in other beings. So, for instance, to look at a monkey or a chimpanzee that's pleading with you not to kill it and say, I'm sorry, since you're not human, I'm going to chop off the top of your head and stick electrodes in, and I really don't care, that violates human dignity in my mind. But to then treat a brain-dead person as if they still have everything and spend tens of thousands of dollars a year to keep this body going, that violates human dignity in my mind, too. And you're saying that we have to treat every brain-dead body as if it's still alive simply because it has human DNA.
No, I'm not saying that at all. First of all, somebody who is, quote, brain-dead is dead. Somebody who's been declared dead by neurological criteria and the brain is not working in any fashion as a brain from the frontal cortex, frontal lobe to the brainstem is dead. I'm not saying that at all. I am saying that when you have somebody who is not brain dead, who has a cognitive disability, whether it's unconsciousness or perceived permanent unconsciousness, which is often misdiagnosed, as you know, or a significant cognitive disability, they remain equal in every way as you or I. And because they have a lower level of cognitive capacity, doesn't make them any less valuable as a human being.
Do you think children and the retarded should be allowed to vote?
No.
Okay,
no,
why not?
They should be allowed to vote. But they should not have the right to life stripped away from them.
I'm not arguing that they should. I'm arguing that they should have a right to life.
Well, you've said in here that not right not to suffer unnecessarily. So you are talking about with regard
to fetuses. That's fetuses. That's not children.
Where does infants come in here? This looks like to me, and this maybe it's because of the printing. And surely severely demented adults, you say, right not to suffer unnecessarily because they're right across from each other. Which would mean, and as you know, people like John Robertson have opined, he's a bioethicist from the University of Texas, that if somebody is in a coma, we should be able, until we destroy the dead donor rule for organ transplantation, that we should be able to take their corneas because they don't need them anymore. That's harvesting human life. That is degrading human life and treating human life, and these are human beings, as less than dignified. And what would we do if they woke up and said, where are my corneas? Because sometimes people who are in comas and who are diagnosed as permanently unconscious do awaken.
Well, you're absolutely correct that my position, my bioethics position, shared by many bioethicists, as you have pointed out in your books.
Yes, that's why I wrote Culture of Death, actually.
Exactly. My position is that if you do no longer have or have never possessed a sense of self which exists over time, which has intents and purposes over time, which discriminates between yourself and your environment, and many permanently unconscious people who still manifest motion and other kinds of apparent life are permanently unconscious and will never possess that sense of self over time, as well as many fetuses and some infants as well. Infants at different stages of, you know, post-birth, that you have different claim on the rest of us than you would otherwise. Now,
that means that what we've done, if your approach is approved by society,
yeah,
is we have destroyed universal human equality and we've transferred that.
You say yourself that we can make a distinction.
Equality for persons.
You said yourself that we can make a distinction on some ground between children and adults in terms of their ability to vote.
Right, but that has nothing to do with their inherent moral worth. Well, they just do not have the maturity to be able to vote and for example, enter into contracts. But that doesn't affect their inherent moral worth.
But this gets to personhood.
And what we now call human rights, which eventually we won't be calling human rights if transhumanists and animal rights types have their
way. That's right, because what should have rights, the only possible thing that could have rights meaningfully, are persons. If you don't have a person inside the thing, then it can't have rights. And but, our and, recognition
and
of
that is a completely subjective approach. In fact, you've already taken it where I knew it would go next. You're now not only distinguishing, it's not only being a person, but you distinguish between a mature person and a person. So first we'll take away the rights of human non-persons, as they're called, and then eventually we may end up with gradations of rights based on personhood or mature personhood.
Well, you've already acknowledged that there are gradations of rights because we allow children to be held as wards of their parents and of the state in ways that we don't allow adults to be, and we allow adults to vote in ways we don't allow children to be. So there are gradations of rights.
The rights I'm talking about are not things like the right to vote or enter into a contract, but the right to life, the right to bodily integrity, the right not to be experimented upon, the right to medical treatment if that is what you or your family desire, and so forth.
And does that extend down to the embryo or the blastocyst? How far do you take it, Wesley?
Well, that's a good question, because if you can go, there's two ways to go. You take yours to the ultimate conclusion, and whole categories of humanity are being stripped of certain moral values that are very important. You take it to the other side, and you might start saying that a 10-cell embryo is the same thing as a 5-year-old child. And I don't accept that. However, I do believe, take abortion out of this, because there you've got this conflict.
I don't think you can take abortion out of this.
I think you have to, because the reason abortion is legal is that we're not wanting, under the law, to force a woman to do with her body that which she does not wish to do. The whole point of abortion was not to turn an embryo or a fetus into a thing that could be used and experimented upon. It was to protect the rights of women to use their bodies as they see fit, and to protect women from being killed in botched illegal abortions.
So, okay, let's take abortion out of this, in the sense that
right.
We have extrauterine gestation at some point. At that point, at the point,
my head's beginning to hurt.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, because I don't think women are especially good at carrying fetuses. They tend to do things like drink, smoke. They don't take their prenatal vitamins, all kinds of things. But
well, I think you've got to be real careful here, because there probably is more to gestation than the mere physical part of it.
And hopefully we'll have that all figured out. But let's get to that point. When we figure it all out and we have a good extrauterine gestation device, and we have a blastocyst.
Well, that will be the end of abortion, because if a woman doesn't want to carry the fetus, then just transfer it to a artificial womb.
Well, say we make six embryos, or six blastocysts.
Yeah.
And we test them to see whether they have the different characteristics that we want. Would you be opposed to the discarding of the five, as we currently do in in vitro fertilization procedures, in order to get to the one? Is that violates human rights?
Well, I'm very disturbed by that. I'll tell you why. In vitro fertilization, which I did not oppose and do not oppose, the point of that was to help infertile couples have a baby. I wasn't part of this debate back when it was being debated. But some of the things that were said by opponents of this was that you would end up making extras that would then just be tossed out. And you would then potentially start looking at these embryos not just as the potential to have a baby, but as fodder. And that is what's going on. So I think we've reached the end of the line in terms of where we should go with this. I think that if somebody wants to check an embryo to see, for example, whether they have Huntington's, that's about as far as I think we should go. When we start saying that we should be able to turn a human embryo, which is a form of human life, into a product and into a commercialized form of life, something that can be patented, then I think we are transitioning from a human approach which says we want these embryos to become children, to one that is unhuman and is very crass and turns human life into a natural resource, which I think is wrong, and which I think will lead to some very unfortunate consequences, not only for those embryos, but for society as a whole.
Well, the commodification of biology is actually an independent question from what rights we give to people. In fact, the two may be in obverse relation. In other words, if I have, as a person, I have a right to control my body, it may be that no one should be able to claim a genetic patent on any part of my body, that only I should be able to control the genetic property of my body. So it may be that granting people rights is actually going to screw up the system of patent law. But let me take you one more place, which is, you mentioned animal rights. So we've touched on personhood theory, your problemhood with that. We've touched on transhumanism, which is you're worried that if we create post-humans that it's going to somehow screw up the rights that we give to other humans. Your problem with animal rights, you know about the Great Ape Project that Peter Singer's involved with. The Great Ape Project proposes that we extend to great apes the rights that you see as essential for humans, that they shouldn't be experimented on without their permission, which, of course, they can't give.
Period, yeah.
Yeah, and that they shouldn't be killed unnecessarily, et cetera, et cetera. And that has absolutely, the people who involved in the Great Ape Project have said nothing about whether human beings should be treated any differently, only to the extent that if we start treating monkeys better, we might treat each other better.
Well,
why don't you buy that argument?
That's not true about Peter Singer. Well, I'm sorry, you know.
Well, Peter Singer has a more complicated set of arguments, but the Great Ape Project involves people who want to treat apes better.
Well,
and they have said nothing
about
how we treat human beings, except that we might treat human beings better if we treat monkeys better.
Well, what happens when, as we now know or suspect, that AIDS and HIV comes from chimpanzees, but chimpanzees don't get ill from it? Should we not be allowed to experiment on chimpanzees to try to make it so that humans can either not get ill from it or can be cured of that horrible disease? I say yes. Under the Great Ape Project, the answer is no. So what you end up doing with the Great Ape Project in certain circumstances is perpetuating or increasing or failing to alleviate human suffering, which should be our first priority, certainly not our only priority, but our first priority. I believe in an animal welfare approach, which looks to not only the suffering caused by animals, but the benefit to humans, and which also posits a human obligation based on human dignity and our empathy and our understanding of what it means to suffer, to try to obtain those human benefits with the least amount of suffering as possible. And that's certainly something that is incredibly human. But to say that animals, apes, elephants, or any animal should be a person equal to a human is misanthropic, because you are saying that we are not special, we are just other animals in the forest, and I submit that it won't be so much that we'll treat some animals better, I think we'll end up treating some people worse.
Is there no form of life, no form of consciousness, say, for instance, a chimpanzee who'd been genetically engineered to have the capacity of speech and to reason as well as a human being, is there no circumstance under which you would recognize that a non-human form of consciousness could be granted permission to enter our polity and participate as an equal with humans?
I don't know the answer to that question, to be frank with you. But I do think that the arguments over that should be completely excluded from how we treat people. In other words, if we're going to decide how animals are to be treated, and I think that's a legitimate and very worthy issue for discourse and for determination, we have to take humans out of the equation. What many animal rightists do is say, for example, well, if we're going to use an animal that has a higher cognitive capacity than a disabled person for research that is to benefit humans, we should not use the animal, we should use the human. And that is often stated by many in animal rights, although most in animal rights say we shouldn't be able to use animals for research at all, as opposed to animal welfare. PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, as you know, say we shouldn't be able to eat them, we shouldn't be able to wear leather, we shouldn't be able to use them in medical experiments, regardless of the human cost that would entail. But if we have, I'm often asked, well, what if an alien comes? You know, how will we decide whether the alien has benefits? Well, you know, we'll deal with that when it comes. My joke is we'll have to worry about them caring about us because they'll be more advanced than us. But these discussions...
But the reason people ask you, Wesley, is because it sounds to us like you are simply a rank anthropocentrist.
Well, I am an anthropocentrist in that sense, but I'm saying that these discussions, you have to take humans out of it, that humans as a species have to be dealt with as a whole, not as individuals, because then none of this is safe. if today I walk out of, after this interview, out of into the backyard and there's this big walnut tree in the neighbor's yard and a branch falls on my head and I become cognitively disabled, I want to be valued just as highly then as I am now.
Okay, most transhumanists have never given any thought to taking away the rights of anyone. They simply want the right to genetically engineer themselves, and most transhumanists aren't terribly interested about reproducing themselves either, unfortunately, since I happen to be a parent. But what most of them are concerned about is genetically engineering themselves to live longer and be smarter, and have more
that's
abilities.
That's not what I'm, you know.
Okay, so do you have any problem with that, with the creation of new categories of post-humanity, as long as it doesn't influence the values of everybody else?
Well, this idea of post-humanity has caused me a lot of concern, because then you could get into the concept of Übermensch and master race kind of thinking. So I'd have to see what you're talking about. If somebody is going to, for example, if you get a prosthesis, right, if you've lost an arm, now, in a sense, that's enhancement. But, of course, I have no objections to that. If I have to wear glasses in a form that's enhancement, there is now something called laser surgery, which I'm not going to get because I don't want to risk it. And I think I look better with glasses. I've been wearing them so long. But if I wanted laser surgery so I no longer needed glasses, that's not changing my nature. That may be improving my capacities to be able to see better. I have no objection to that. But there comes a point where instead of having as a tool to make me function better, you're beginning to change the nature of the person. So when you talk about, as you do, I mean, some of this sounds very futuristic, and it is, but the idea of people melding their consciousnesses into several, you know, you can explain it better than I am. I've just read what you've written. But the idea of group identities and downloading into computers and this kind of thing, the Raelians, who I have debated, I debated Brigitte Bussier at the University of Alabama. My understanding of what the Raelians want and the reason they're in favor of human cloning is they think that they're materialists. They're often called a religious cult. I think they're a science cult because they're materialists. They don't believe in evolution. They believe that aliens came here and created all life on the planet through cloning processes and so forth. But that their road to immortality, they say, is to clone themselves and then download their minds into the clones successively. I'm a big fan of Star Trek, Deep Space Nine. I don't know if you watched it, but there was a great character called Wyun, who was one of the great bad guys on the show. And every time Wyun would be killed, his clone would be back with all knowledge that, you know, occurred to the previous Wyuns.
Right.
That was a fun character, and I enjoyed that, but I think the Raelians are taking that quite seriously. So I think that, I guess what I'm, again, taking a little too long to say is we have to distinguish between something that is, a tool for you to perform better versus changing nature.
Okay. I guess the nub of my disagreement with the article, the argument that you lay out, is not that that these different trends, certain versions of animal rights, certainly not all, but certain versions, personhood theory, and some versions of transhumanism, not that they don't raise the question of whether there should be a readjustment of the types of rights that are granted to different kinds of beings, but rather that they necessitate any readjustment. In other words, I think you could have the current apportionment of rights to different human beings in different statuses stay exactly the same, raise the rights that we grant to certain kinds of animals, such as, for instance, chimpanzees and apes, and allow human beings the right to transform themselves and perhaps their progeny to become, to live longer, to have green skin, whatever things transhumanists want to do. And those things could be part of that greater human family as well.
Have you considered what will happen to cohesive society if we get to the places, one of the articles I read had, that post-humans were so different from humans that they wouldn't even be able to procreate together anymore? What, you know, we could become a centrifuge that just, everything just splatters out into a lack of cohesion, and you can have tremendous disintegration.
Do you think that the reason that we give Chinese equal rights in the United States is because Anglos can procreate with them? I don't think that the ability to procreate with things is really the defining characteristic of whether they should have rights
or not. But that's avoiding my question.
It's the answer
to
your question.
The idea of race, as we know, is really not real. Humans, you can't cross pigs with cows, but you can cross Chinese with African or with the black folk because we're all the same.
The ability to procreate has nothing to do with rights.
But you're talking about something much more than that. And I'm saying I haven't seen, and I certainly have not read all the transhumanist literature out there, but I haven't seen any thought given to the consequences of a society where people have such a lack of commonality, where the only real, as I'm looking at it, perhaps the only isn't the right word, but the substantial agreed-upon ethos is that there will be nothing other than what the person wants to do, and you could end up with such a polyglot society, and I'm not talking about language, that the cohesion completely falls apart.
Well, we have given substantial thought to that. If you look at the use of the term transhumanism in the works of Bruce Sterling, such as in his Schismatrix novels, and of course the interplay and the boundaries between science fiction and transhumanist writing are kind of porous. But at any rate, that is in fact the meaning of transhumanism in his book, is the movement, the political movement to create and establish a common civic mindedness and a polity that includes both humans and post-humans of all varieties. And for me, and that is a central part of this movement for me as well, for me, one of the central questions is, what is of value in life? What is it that we want to protect about life? And for me, the answer is consciousness, that consciousness is the gift that the universe has given us, and it is the gift that we need to perpetuate and appreciate by doing our best to raise it in every form that we find it. You, on the other hand, seem to think it's human DNA which has given us value. And those two views, that consciousness is of value and that human DNA is of value, will, as you point out, I think, come into inevitable conflict.
Right. I wouldn't say it's human DNA, but I do think being human, if we're to enjoy equal rights, which is what we've been striving for a long time now, is universal human equality. And it strikes me that the threat to that, just as we are getting rid of racism and sexism and things of that sort, which I, of course, support, we're now saying we're going to find other ways to discriminate against certain humans. So what I see happening, and I'm not saying this is the intent, but I think it's the effect, is that you're just going to create new forms of discrimination, but you'll have different victims, and those would be the people who have less cognitive capacity. You know, one of the best people I ever met, Jim, was a developmentally disabled man named Davey, who I took care of for 3 years. He was my former brother-in-law. Davey's died, but he had a significant mental retardation. He had grand mal seizures, and he was one of the most sweet, gentle, kind, forgiving, wanting to be helpful humans I've ever met. If the rest of the world was like Davey,
I hear this argument a lot, that disabled people are all wonderful and have wonderful abilities.
Wonderful. Well, I'm just saying, Davey is the kind of person who would be, basically wiped out
I hear this argument a lot. What percentage of the population, if we had the ability to screen and to make sure that there was no congenitally mentally retarded people in the next generation of humanity, what percentage would you think we should ideally have?
I don't think that we should create. I think we should allow nature to take its course.
Well, that gives over to if you're a religious conservative, I understand where that comes from. God sends retarded people to us for a reason. We have to accept whatever God gives. If you are, on the other hand, a public health advocate or someone who believes in the capacity of society to rationally determine its own affairs, I think it's the ideal answer. The obvious answer is the fewest number of retarded people as possible, because there's something about having a fully functioning human brain which is of value, and which all parents seem to choose for their children when given, almost all parents seem to choose for their children when given an opportunity. Now, the transhumanists are not for any kind of public coercion, for the most part. They are only for people having the right to make this decision. And it's precisely people like yourself and the disability rights movement who say, no, you shouldn't be allowed to determine that you not have disabled children, because you should be forced by the state to take whatever chance sends you.
Well, no, I don't think that's quite right. What I'm saying is that every one of us, however we come, should be as appreciated and equal with the rest of us. And I'm also saying that, and I think there's great benefit to this, that people like Davey, I used to wonder, how could somebody like Davey,
If you could fix Davey, would you fix him? If you could fix him, would you fix him? If you could make him have a normal intelligence, would you? Is his retardation what you value about Davey? Is it that you like having a human pet?
That's really unfair.
Well, when we talk about human dignity,
not a pet. He had great dignity. He was not a pet.
Okay, when we talk about human dignity, the notion that there's somehow an inherent value in having someone who has to be a ward and a dependent strikes me as peculiar.
Yeah, but you know, that's part of what makes us so special as a race. We take care of our weak. We take care of our vulnerable. I would take one of Davy's greatest treats was to go to the grocery store. I bought him a hat, a kind of a jaunty hat. We got him out of a mental institution where he was treated abominably. And we take him to the grocery store. He was thrilled. And I watched people react to Davy. Their faces would light up. They would talk to him. And I was watching people, and this is maybe a little metaphysical for you, but I was watching people, I thought, plant seeds of unconditional love. They were loving Davy and reaching out to Davy and being gracious and friendly and kind to Davy without any thought of return.
So that's why God sends us. That's why God sends us retarded people.
That's what the idea of everything is rational misses. There's more to life.
Are you saying that God sends us retarded people to make us all happy?
No, of course not.
Okay, would you have fixed Davy if you could have? If you could have given him a pill?
I probably would have. Yeah.
Okay, then there's nothing inherently valuable about his being retarded, and maybe he could have brought people happiness in their lives not being retarded.
But there was something inherently valuable about Davy retarded. That's the point I'm making.
Davy, as a person, was inherently valuable, but his retardation was a problem that if we can fix, we should. It's precisely why we don't allow parents to whack their kids in the head with bricks, because we feel that kids who don't have brain damage are better than kids who do have brain damage.
I'm not one of the disability rights advocates who say it is somehow wrong to give somebody a cochlear implant so they can hear.
Glad to hear.
I quite agree with you. And in fact, one of the things we worked really hard on at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute was to get his medication proper so he had far fewer grand mal seizures. The point I'm making is that where I think bioethics is going wrong, and certainly transhumanism, is that you begin to look on people like Davy as having no value or very little value, and start saying they are not persons and they do not have the same rights as other persons, and I'm talking about the basic rights such as life and bodily integrity. There are people out there who are part of the bioethics movement who would have seen Davy, because he was self-aware over time, but many would say he was not a person, who would say that, you know, his life was of less value than my life, and therefore we should be able to do things to him that we couldn't do to me, and that's where I object.
I don't know of any bioethicist who's ever said that about the retarded. The only thing the bioethicists say is that if a person is so cognitively disabled that they have no sense of personhood over time, that they no longer are part of the human family.
Well, I've seen people like Peter Singer say that if a Down syndrome child is born, that child should be allowed to be infanticized.
In the state of infancy.
Right.
Because in the state of infancy, you have a different...
Persons.
They're not a person.
Exactly
then.
My problem. So persons, then infants, newborn infants, become endangered by this theory, and it doesn't matter whether they...
It doesn't matter whether they're retarded or not.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's my point.
Yes, that's right.
That's my point.
Infancy.
All along.
Well, let's come back to infancy. Yes. When we have extrauterine gestation, we will be faced with the decision of when to decant children.
What do you mean by decant?
To take them out of the extrauterine gestation device, whatever it is.
This vocabulary is driving me crazy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have some kind of...
We're going to decant children now instead of give birth to them. Okay.
Well, you know, for those who have them in this device, I'm saying if we're going to separate the question of when you are allowed to terminate the life of this developing fetus, embryo, whatever, from it being inside a human woman, then we're going to get to that point some point. We're going to have them in these machines, and the question will be, at what point are you allowed to destroy it?
Perhaps at no point, because at that point, you're not forcing a woman to do with her body that which she does not wish to do.
And if right to lifers,
well, let me finish.
And if Catholic right to lifers control our future, then yes.
No one's forcing this embryo and fetus to be created. But once they're created, does human life have ultimate value simply because it's human? If the answer to that is yes, then I think we can go forward into the future protecting universal human equality. But if the answer is no, then some of us are going to be opted out. And I don't see any reason.
If the answer is yes, in vitro fertilization is impossible because we always create extra embryos that we are then destroyed.
That is towards, and that's what I said, I think we've gone as far as we can go. Those embryos are being created for the purpose of bringing a baby into the world. And, of course, in nature, some embryos don't make it. But when you cross a certain line and you're now saying we can then decide to experiment on these embryos and fetuses, I mean, I don't see why not fetuses. A lot of people are saying we should wait only for the first 14 days, but that makes no sense on a personhood basis because a two-month gestated fetus has no more rights or value in a personhood analysis than does a 10-day-old embryo. Would you agree with that?
On a personhood basis, yes. The distinction would be, for me, between before third trimester and after third trimester.
And the third trimester is because you're beginning to get the
sensation,
brain waves and so forth.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is taking some forms of human life, and now we're talking about the fetus or the embryo that is in an artificial womb. I don't see any reason to be able to destroy that because I don't accept personhood theory as the value of life. The abortion issue has to do with a conflict between the rights of the fetus embryo and the rights of the woman to bodily integrity, and society has decided which way that's going to go.
And if we could get those pesky women out of the way, then every two-celled human being should have rights.
Well, it seems to me that once you've created human life and you have an embryo, that you should not be able to experiment on it, and you should not be able to just use it as a thing. And I think there should be some very real care taken at that level. I don't see any reason to permit that kind of commodification of human life.
Well, how about, for instance, if we're trying to eradicate disease and allow people to live a lot longer, and we need to use embryos up to a 36-cell stage in order to do that experimentation.
Well, what
and,
if we
and
needed,
parents...
We needed to use living fetuses at 4 months.
You can take me there, and I'm not unwilling to go.
We're talking
yeah.
about the same thing.
I'm not unwilling to go there. Okay, let's say embryos up to 4 months.
Yeah.
Would you use a 4-month embryo for the purpose of doing research that will have important results for humanity? You're saying that we can take a fully alive chimpanzee. You have no problem with taking a fully alive chimpanzee that's sitting there pleading with you not to do anything to it, but to take an embryo.
Aren't you anthropomorphizing yourself there?
No, I'm respecting the personhood and the sense and the sensate consciousness of other beings, and that I think is the essential definition for me of human dignity. That if you can look into another being's eyes and recognize that it's looking back at you and that it has that kind of self that you have, that is human dignity. Not to look at some fish-like being which happens to be made from human DNA, which has none of that capacity to look back at you and pretend that that's human. That is not the essential.
Well, you're pretending a chimp is human, but in terms of taking care of experimenting on the chimps, I think you can create criteria, and I believe that a chimp should be less experimented on than a mouse, based on some of the very criteria you talked about. But as I said, there has to be a firewall between how we treat humans, and I do think that in compelling cases, chimps should be able to be experimented on. So should all great apes, so should, if necessary, any other animal, assuming a sufficient human good from that and everything we can do to prevent suffering.
But no embryo?
I don't believe, because a chimp is intelligent,
but no embryo.
The equivalent of a person. I don't believe we should experiment on human life in that fashion, because I think not only would it affect the embryo and the fetus, but in a consequentialist view, it would begin to affect, as we've discussed, newborn infants.
No matter what the benefits, we should never do any research on even a one-celled human life, no matter what the benefit.
That would be, I'm not willing to quite be that absolutist, but I think that the general standard should be we don't treat human life as a commodity.
Okay, well, this is a conversation we're going to have to continue. I hope you...
I think it's one of the most and most important conversations we can have.
I absolutely agree.
And I think that the one thing that needs to be recognized is that both sides in this very important debate, which I'm afraid most of society isn't aware of, have good faith and want to do what's best for all of us. to the best potential possible. We have very different principles, I think, and value systems, and we have different visions of what the transhumanist future would actually lead to. I think you're very utopian in your outlook, and I think, as with most, and if not all, utopian enterprises, it ends in tragedy and conflagration. I think utopianism it's not religion that causes us problems or ideology so much as utopianism, because eventually, in order to justify getting heaven on earth, to use a phrase, a lot of things can be justified to try to get that incredible good that caused tremendous harm. And I think, especially personhood theory, as we've discussed with newborn infants and others, you see tremendous potential for human harm. And the same thing is true as if we bring animals into the same category of life as humans.
I've been speaking with Wesley Smith. He's the co-author of four books with Ralph Nader, including No Contest, Corporate Lawyers, and the Perversion of Justice in America. He wrote The Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America, which annoyed a lot of the medical ethicists that I know.
to say the least.
Yeah. He's also the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, and he's currently writing a book about the unholy convergence of transhumanism, animal rights, and a number of other cultural trends. You can read a small piece of that in the National Review Online, the article Transhumanists, the Next Great Threat to Human Dignity. Thanks for joining us today, Wesley. I'm sure that you will be back.
I would look forward to it, and I enjoyed our conversation.
Okay. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.